Maybe it's a bit general, but like I mean, we have seen bosonic strings so far, and you have mentioned that when we apply supersymmetry, we get supersymmetric string theory when we
Yes.
represent fermions. I was curious if fermionic strings, like purely fermionic strings, are a thing that is interesting, or if it isn't.
What does the pure fermionic mean?
I don't know. Just because we have bosonic strings and we somehow end up incorporating them in supersymmetric strings. I assume that there is some notion of.
So, if you want to have some kind of space-time, you will want some coordinates as fields on your worksheet. So you'll typically want to have some scalar fields on the worksheet. If you put no scalar fields on your worksheet, you're going to describe a string theory that does something very exotic, has no space-time or no time. Might be difficult to interpret as a physical theory, but could definitely still be interesting for other purposes. The main difference between bosonic strings and superstrings is that it's not as much. It's sort of. It's actually not the presence of fermions per se on the worksheet. To be honest, there is something called GSO projection, which is done precisely to throw away the fermions. But rather, the structure required, it's. They're not string theories in a conformal gauge. They are something else, which is based on kind of some kind of super conformal gauge. So originally, we introduced the metric on the worksheet as a crutch to linearize, to make nice the minimal R reaction. But once you do that, you can start wondering if you can do other things of the same sort. So to get superstring theory, what you do is to say, OK, what if I put supergravity on the worksheet? Which means you put both a spin true metric and also spin 3/2 background gravitino, so-called. And then you sort of run to the same procedure of trying to get rid of this after you've introduced it. Or, you know, in a sense, you ask, okay, what can I sort of do something similar where I impose diffeomorphism and while and maybe some other fermionic symmetries, which get sort of gauge fix the degrees of freedom of this supergravity. And you can. Your Riemann surface gets equipped with what's called a super conformal structure, sort of a conformal structure. And then you get some integrals for the moduli space or super conformal structures. And you proceed in a formal way, and you get these superstring theories. Now, superstring theories happen to have sometimes fermions on the target space, which is a nice feature. But I don't even know if it's a necessary thing. Like, could you possibly have fermions in space-time even if you had bosonic strings, maybe? I don't know. So it's again more like, okay, we try to do these. These things look nice. They have nice features. Let's study them. Sorry, so I hope, I don't know if at the end of the lectures I'll be able to discuss superstring theories a little bit. Other questions? Okay, today I want to discuss a little bit Beeristic quantization. It's an interesting subject and it's a rich subject. And let's see, how is it introduced usually? I don't know if you see any of it in the quantization of gauge theory. Perhaps that's the first question I should ask. Have you ever seen a ghost? Something? OK. Right, so perhaps you remember that the difficult problem that you face is that you need to learn how to integrate over some space of field configurations, modulo gauge transformations. So a gauge symmetry is just a redundancy in a description. It means that I want you to describe some phase space, some system, but it's very curved and nonlinear. And so I try to describe it as a linear system, modulo some symmetry. And then I want to figure out a way to integrate over the space of configurations of the original system rather than the space of configurations of this auxiliary system. Let me try to give you a pictorial example. Suppose I want to do an integral over the positive real line. But for some bizarre reason, I've been forbidden from using the positive real line, and I can only think about it as the radial direction in the plane. So for some reason, I'm forced to do an integral over the plane. Now, suppose I try to do something like this. Will that work? What goes wrong? What should I do to fix it?
Is the measure?
No, the measure is wrong. Dx squared equal this correct, sorry, equals r dr d phi. The integrand is invariant under rotation, so I can put the 1 over 2 pi and be done with the d phi. But this r is a problem, so I need to somehow divide these, put a 1 over absolute value of x if I want to reproduce the integral I actually care about. So, in general, I have some action that I gauge fix in some way, right? And then I realize that if I integrate over the original measure, well, I'm not doing what I want to do, first of all, and second, the answer will change if I change the gauge fixing. And to fix that, you find that you need to insert the determinant of some Jacobian, like this. This 1 over r is just the determinant of Jacobian of the coordinate transformation from xs to r and phi. And now, in quantum field theory, this functional determinant, very hard to compute, and the trick is to replace it with something like this, where B and C are some auxiliary fermions. Because when you do a Gaussian integral over fermions, you get determinants. Then later on, people realize that there is this new action has a symmetry. Now, a point I want to stress, it's kind of silly, but I think perhaps it's worth it. See, this determinant of J felt like something quantum, right? Had to do with a measure. But now we pushed it up into the action. So we made the discussion kind of classical in some sense. Anyway, people realized that there is a symmetry called the Biresti symmetry, which acts on this combined thing, the gauge fixed plus Ghost action. And this is a symmetry which is Grassmann odd, meaning it maps fermions to bosons. And vice versa, so it's a bit of a weird symmetry. And also squares to zero. And then something else people realize that if you try to compare two different gauge fixings of the same action, they typically sort of differ by amounts which are in the image of Q. And at least classically, this is actually enough to show that the integrals are equivalent. Meaning we'll discuss it in greater detail, but whenever this kind of symmetry, if I add something in the image of Q to the action, nothing changes. Again, this is not surprising as it should be. I don't know. If you have an integral like that, which is rotationally invariant, and you put inside a function which is not rotationally invariant, you get zero, right? It will average to zero. Now, if I try to add e to the I-phi up, then that won't work because, or I don't know, something like e to the I-phi plus e to the minus I-phi. Perhaps I should have said sine of phi, whatever, cosine of phi. This will not work because when I expand the exponential, I'll get cosine squared and stuff like that, which are invariant. But when you do something like that, sort of, because Q is fermionic and squares to zero, you sort of don't have to worry about nonlinear stuff. Okay, this is very loose. I could have done better, but let's just leave it at that. I don't want to spend too much time on it. So this nice feature, whenever I have a system which has this kind of odd nilpotent symmetries, I can modify my action in a certain way without changing the answer. And this seems to know about the original gauge symmetry. And furthermore, this is useful in practice because quantization is tricky. It's full of ambiguities. It's very easy for quantization to mess up your original gauge symmetry so that when you quantize gauge fixed things, you get different answers. But if you can make sure that this symmetry persists in the quantum theory, then you are good. Different gauge fixing will still be equivalent. So ensuring that the Bresti symmetry is still there is a very economical way to show that you've correctly quantized your system, your gauge system. Now, as I was saying, although we're trying to solve quantum problems, part of the story is purely classical, okay? I avoid this classical action, gauge fixed plus ghosts, and it has this classical symmetry. And so people in time started realizing that if you learn this heuristic quantization properly, you're actually learning stuff about classical geometry. So there is a whole branch of geometry where you learn that it's quite useful to have fermions and bosons in your geometry, and to have a symmetry that relates, that is Grassmann-odd and squares to zero. And indeed, if you go and look back at things which are done even before you knew about Bresti quantization, like cohomology, you realize that, it's actually all about things like that. So, sort of in the notes, I found myself writing examples of these sort of systems which have this kind of symmetry and possible uses you can put into it. And I don't know if this is clarifying or confusing, potentially, both. I think in general, mathematicians have found that in a lot of situations when you try to study problems like how do I deform a system? Sometimes you find all sorts of obstructions and problems in deforming systems. And they found that using this technology is actually a good way to think about the formation of a system. And again, quantum field theory is a lot about deformations. So it's another way to understand it. Anyway, so it just comes in a lot of places, in a lot of guises, and you might encounter it in one way when you study a certain physical problem, but there are many perspectives that are useful to keep in mind. So I'm curious, did you encounter differential forms? Because if you did, then this could be a good example and I can discuss it. If you didn't, then I'm just going to confuse the matter. I saw something in the previous lecture that sounded like differential forms. Is that a good thing? Okay. So lightning review of differential forms. What's a differential form? Differential form is a is something of this is an object. It's a generalization of a function. You have a function of some variables, and I'm going to add some new symbols, which have the same labels as the variables. Except the anti-commute. So that's a differential form. What do I use differential forms for? Well, one thing you can use differential forms for is doing integrals. So if you have a form which has a certain number of dx's inside, you can define, and you have some manifold of dimension n, you can integrate the form nicely without having to introduce a measure, a metric, or anything else. So forms can be integrated canonical or manifold. And you know, you can write a formula, something like, okay, I pick some local coordinates on my manifold, or my submanifold. I do something like the integral of f i1 to in, and then something like the determinant of dx i, i1. I want to write a matrix, ia, the ub, the u1, all the way to the un. We already saw an example, actually, when we were studying the B field, and how to integrate the B field on a worksheet, or how to integrate a gauge connection on a word line. That is sort of formula always. This formula, right, because you had this determinant, if you change your local coordinates on the submanifold, the answer will not change. And you can ask, what if I change the coordinates of the original manifold, or the ambient space? Well, I just need to make sure that when I change coordinate systems, my dx's transform in a sort of graphically obvious way. The antisymmetry is useful because it makes sure that this expression is antisymmetric. The determinant is also antisymmetric. So, right, forms come out naturally when I try to integrate things on submanifolds without having to specify a metric. And very now, a beautiful property of integration is the Stokes theorem. You can integrate total derivatives by part. And the Stokes theorem is also nicely described in the language of forms. There is this operation that takes a form and gives you a new form with one extra dx. How do I define it? Well, it satisfies Leibniz. So it's a derivation, and also maps x to dx, and maps dx to 0. If you use these two rules and use the Leibniz rule, you can get everything. Okay. And why we care about this is because I was saying the integral over mu of df is the integral over the boundary of mu of f. And in particular, if I'm integrating over closed integration cycles, integrals of d something are 0. This might remind you of something like, okay, if I change the action by a q, something in the image of q is 0. So this there is an analog of the BRST symmetry in this problem. I have bosonic objects, the x's, fermionic objects, the dx's, and have a map relating them. Now, the Stokes theorem I want to say this properly. So what is cohomology? Cohomology is about, maybe I'll just use a new board. Cohomology is about studying function forms which are closed, which are annihilated by the modulo forms that are in the image of the. Why would I care about that? Well, first of all, I might care about that if I want studying integrals of forms on closed things. Or let me say it in a bit more intrinsic way. If I want to study the topology of a manifold, one thing I can study is the submanifolds while keeping track of boundaries of things. For example, I can ask, OK, what are the closed submanifolds? And perhaps I can study closed submanifolds up to the formations of these closed submanifolds. So I can say, OK, suppose I want to study an annulus. I don't know. The fact that the annulus has a hole is visible by the fact that there are closed submanifolds, which are not the boundary of anything. The disk, on the other hand, does not have a hole. And I can see by the fact that if I take a submanifold like this, it's always the boundary of something. So submanifolds modulo boundaries is a nice topological thing. It's called homology. But it's a very nonlinear thing because I'm studying submanifolds or weird shapes. On the other hand, this formula sort of tells you that studying submanifolds modulo boundaries has some close relation to study forms modulo exactings. Like if you have a closed submanifold, integrals on a closed submanifold will always be, will not see any form which is in the image of there. But furthermore, if I deform my submanifold, I'll deform it by, the difference between two will be the boundary of something. And so if I make sure that my f was in the, was killed by there, then this answer will not change if I deform my my submanifold. So this cohomology, you can show it's sort of dual to the homology. It captures the same information. But it does so by looking at something very linear, which is the space of forms, forms killed by the forms in the image of the. Okay. So somehow, by adding these fermionic symbols and this symmetry, we have taken something which had a lot of structure, like a manifold, and we have recovered the topology, information about the topology. In a very concrete sense, we have torn away all of the local structure of the manifold, kept only global things. Or if you want, we have erased sort of the local coordinates, local stuff, bosonic stuff, by adding some fermions and only looking at things where bosons and fermions cancel. So why is this an interesting example for discussing ghosts? Because this is kind of what we're trying to do to the gauge orbits. So when we're trying to integrate over the space of gauge orbits, We don't want to care about how the gauge orbits were embedded in the auxiliary space. Maybe some of them were big, some were, could have been small, and maybe they were deformed in weird ways. They had a lot of local information about how they were living in the big space. We want to throw away this local information. And to throw away this local information, we kind of need to introduce analogs of these DXs. And those are the C ghosts. The C ghosts are precisely, we precisely have one C ghost for every direction along the gauge orbits. And what these C ghosts do is just they erase the effect of the geometry of these gauge orbits. It's like you're doing a partial cohomology. You're not doing a cohomology, you know, you just sort of want to make the gauge orbit behave topologically while keeping the space you want to integrate over interesting. Okay. Now, so the C ghosts, I want to think about them as sort of forms along gauge orbits. Okay. So that's half of the story of the BST quantization. The other half is the B ghosts. So when you do your gauge fixing, you want to somehow get to treat the gauge orbits topologically. You also want to treat sort of the choice of gauge fixing topologically. So now let me give a different problem. Suppose that I have some function, the delta function. Okay. So you have surely encountered this object, right? This is the property that if I integrate some function of x against the delta function of x, and they you know, on an interval that includes zero, this gives me the function at zero. And perhaps you have also encountered delta of a function of x. Do you remember what happens if I do integral of f of x again delta of function of x? And sorry, my delta and my f are surprisingly similar today. I don't know why. Okay. Remember what this is?
1 over the derivative of the zeros.
Right, zeros. That's right. So there is a sum over the zeros. And there is 1 over, forget the conventions, absolute value of the derivative. Is there absolute value? I don't remember. There is, right? I say delta minus x is the same as delta x. That seems reasonable. Okay. Absolute value of f prime of x times the function at this point x. Okay. So how would I make sure to instead have something which just picks these at the zeros of f? What if I only care about the zeros of f and the actual choice of f was not something I care about? How do I fix this problem? Well, I just include this absolute value of the derivative. There. Now, there are, this is good. There are situations, though, in which I actually care about putting some signs in here. So, suppose we're studying a little bit of a different problem. Counting how many times a function intersects the real axis. If I just count the number of times it intersects it, this is definitely not invariant under the formations of the function. This is 3, this is 1. But if I were to count it, the sign of the derivative at the place, then this would be invariant under the formations of the function. Indeed, it would be 0 if the function is large and positive on both ends, 0 if it's large and negative on both ends, 1 if it's negative on one end and positive on the other, and -1 otherwise. Now, this sort of, if we are trying to do a gauge fixing of some orbits, this is definitely the sort of thing we want. Because we kind of want to count each orbit once. On the other hand, if my gauge fixing function is weird, maybe it will intersect 3 times the orbit at some place and once somewhere else. I don't even know how to draw that, but perhaps I can try. Right, I could try to gauge fix in some weird way. What if I want to still get the right answer from an integral done that way? Yes?
This is for any gauge fixing or for gauge fixing that are linear on the gauge field?
Any gauge fixing. So for that reason, it's actually interesting to have a situation where I have f prime over absolute value of f prime here. And it's actually even easier here. It means I can do that. And then this combination is actually very natural because I can think about it as just being delta of f df. Right? The delta function is naturally a form. So where is the BRST symmetry here? Well, let me say this. I want to say this properly. How do I realize, do you know of any formula which produces a delta function? Like in Fourier transform, have you ever seen a delta function? Right, the Fourier transform of 1 is a delta function. So a way to produce a delta function is to write an integral of e to the I b of f. And then, how would I produce an f prime? Well, I can treat it as fat f pof for determinant of some sort. Something like b f prime dx. Or c, let me call it c. And I kind of want to bring the dx. This is going to be essentially dx. So, if I do this integral, I'll just reproduce integral is a very complicated way to write essentially 1 or the number of times the function intersects the real axis in this integration region. And this happens to have a symmetry. There is a symmetry where you send x to c, much as before, but only b to capital B. And the if you use this symmetry, maybe I, then I. And this combination is nothing else but Q of B F of X. So the fact that this integral was actually independent of F, only dependent on the topology on F, is manifested by the fact that if I change f, I'm just changing the action by something exact in the image of q. And so it guarantees that this will not, the answer will not change. So the Fadeo-Poppel determinant is just a somewhat more complicated generalization of this, where we have many functions and many directions that you want to eliminate. So and you should be able to recognize the gauge fixing procedure if you have seen it in the gauge theory, right? These become just the gauge fixing conditions imposed by the S delta function by integral against B. And then this is the Fadeo-Poppel determinant. And once you're here, though, you can add Q of a lot of other things to get exotic variants of gauge fixing. For example, I could add Q of BB, which would add a B squared here. This replaces the delta function with a Gaussian. But still, the integral of this Gaussian gives me the correct answer, 1 or minus 1 or whatever. So you can get sort of fuzzy versions of gauge fixing where you allow yourself to sort of average over many different ways of fixing things. Right. And at some point, perhaps you, during the process, there is a moment in which something illuminates and you stop thinking about this as a gauge fix and you start thinking about the original problem as the original classical problem as being written naturally in this sort of BRST geometry or derived geometry, it's called. where you start thinking that it's perhaps natural to try to describe a complicated manifold as living inside a bigger manifold which has both fermions and bosons and an odd vector field Q such that the zeros of Q give you the manifold you care about. Odd nilpotent vector field. Now, a point perhaps I should stress is that, so this is so good in many ways, there is still a price to pay. Nothing comes completely for free. Here, the price is that we introduce these ghosts. In quantum field theory, there will be things like fermions, which are scalars and not spinners. That sort of tells you that you're going to sacrifice unitarity along the way. And that it's not guaranteed that what you produce will be unitary. So, you know, you need to, at some point, you need to check that your kernel of Q divided by image of Q, which are the observables of your operators or states of your theory, is unitary. So typically you have, say, a Hilbert space with an inner product. Inner product is not positive definite, but if you restrict yourself to the kernel and the quotient by the image, then it's positive definite. On the other hand, the ability to gauge to change your gauge fixing freely might make the check easy in the sense that you might find a unitary gauge or something like that where the cancellation between sort of gauge degrees of freedoms and ghosts is particularly transparent and you can show that you can show unitarity. Maybe that gauge was not great for other reasons, maybe to break Lorentz invariance or whatnot, but you know that going to the Lorentz invariant gauge is not going to cost you the theory. So, not so bad, but it's something to keep in mind. So, Like at some point when you do BRST quantization of string theory, you need to prove an August theorem that, you know, the Hilbert space is unitary. Okay, any questions? Okay, let's see, what else do I need? Perhaps the only thing I need is to, let's see. Well, honestly, I think this is probably enough to understand most of the things we'll do with ghosts. So what's going to happen in string theory? Well, actually, no, there is something I want to mention. I think it's still a bit important. So here, sort of work very hard to throw away completely the gauge degrees of freedoms. That's great. But sometimes it's not possible. Meaning, you know, at the end, you want to do things that are, say, local. And how do you deal with, you know, maybe some of the gauge degrees of freedom would require to do something local to be killed. You don't want to do that. You don't want to lose locality. So there are situations where you might want to live with some unfixed, with a finite collection of unfixed gauge symmetries, and also live with a situation that perhaps the constraints are imposing might be too strong. Maybe you impose too many gauge fixing constraints, and you want to be able to relax that a little bit. To do so, you could perhaps have a family of gauge fixing constraints, so that instead of setting your function, somehow you have a bunch of functions you want to set to zero of your original variables, and maybe you allow yourself to have extra variables and to set these to zero. So implicitly, you have to find the value of the t's. Let's see, what could be an example? I don't know, in this picture, perhaps I was trying to impose two gauge fixing constraints. Seems a bit much. But if I say, oh, I fix x and I fix y, but I fix them to be both equal to t, and I let t vary, then I'm getting really a family of these with a bunch of points, which, as I vary t, will still give me the trajectory I want. And in string theory, we kind of need both. You already know we need both. Why? Because I said, if I have a metric, I can get rid of most of the metric with gauge symmetries, but not all of the metric. So if I try to tell you how the metric is just flat, that's too strong. I cannot do it globally. The best I can do is to say, the metric equals some reference metric that I particularly like. Maybe it's flat in a whole bunch of places and connected in some way or other way otherwise. And it's a function of what I call complex structures. I pick some specific coordinates on the space of complex structures that I like. And I want to impose a gauge fixing constraints like that. How do I do that? And then conversely, there is sometimes the problem that even after I say that a metric is flat, there still are some symmetries, some diffeomorphisms left. Like, if you say I'm on the plane, I might put a flat metric on the plane. Translations leave the metric flat. They're a diffeomorphism that I did not gauge fix. So I will have to gauge fix it by hand. So without belaboring the point too much, let me just give you a general principle. So unfixed
gauge symmetries. Are dealt by insertions of C in the path integral. Essentially, you're trying to make sure that if you integrate, so I'm going to say, okay, I'm going to integrate by hands on some parts of the gauge orbit and divide by the volume of the gauge orbit later on. In order to do so, I need a measure on the to do this integration. And I want a canonical measure of some sort. The right way is to integrate not a function, but to integrate a form. So I want to integrate the top form on whatever residual orbits. A top form is just, you know, a product of the axes. And the dx's are just the same as c's. So at some point, you might see in calculations we do that we do an integral or a blah, 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 correlation function, and we put by hand three c's. Well, just because that's because there was a three-dimensional space of gauge symmetries that we are integrating over by hand. And this is just the volume form, you know, a top form in that space. A three-dimensional form on the space. Conversely, parametric constraints, such as this one, end up giving you insertions of B. And okay, you can try to think about, you know, why would I do that? But intuitively, if you put some insertions of B by hand, it's like you're, and I say this right, and I don't think I'll be able to say right without spending too much time. Perhaps I should just say a formula. So if I want to impose an equation, a constraint like f of x and t equal to 0, I can do so by putting by hand something that looks like this, dtf of x and t times b, where b is just whatever b was appearing in front of. So it's like I'm putting this thing and putting it by hand. In some sense. But with it, sorry. OK, in the note, you can find the derivation of this fact. But let's just say that inserting something like that allows you to work with parametric constraints. And so in gauge theory, in order to deal with something like this, well, we'll pretty much insert something that looks like, okay, I have my derivative respect of tau of HAB, and then I contract it some B ghost, I integrate over the worksheet, and I put that inside my correlation function. But we will never encounter it because this is only needed when you have modelized spaces of compact structures, which typically happens at loops. So at tree level, we sort of manage without. But there's something to keep in mind when you try to understand formula in the Polchinski. Okay, so these are sort of the two last pieces that you might not be familiar with from gauge theory. Because, but are useful.
But in gauge theory, sometimes it happens like that you cannot impose the gauge fixing globally, but that.
Yeah, you're right, you're right. There are definitely gauge theory situations. I mean, I can even discuss one briefly. Suppose that your space-time has a circle. The one of the direction is a circle. And you want to set an axial gauge. Can I do that?
what could be an obstruction. Like suppose, for example, that A3 is equal to 1. Sorry, that's not very, yeah, okay, 1. Show me gauge transformation that can map it to 0.
A3 goes to D of minus X3 or something like that.
Yes, yes, that's right. So you could say the gauge parameter X3. But is X3 a function on this geometry? It's not. So I cannot use this gauge parameter. So in general, this is a non-trivial deformation. So the only thing I can do is to set A3 equal to theta, where theta is a real parameter. It actually goes from 0 to 2 pi because in a U1 gauge theory, lambda equal to 2 pi x3 over L. Actually, so x3 over L might actually be allowed because under this it shifts. The thing that really matters is e to the I lambda. So e to the I x3 over L is a fine function on the circle. So here there is something like 1 over 2 pi L. Okay. But right, if I wanted to do an axial gauge, I would have to allow myself to use a theta. And so, strictly speaking, somewhere in the calculations, I had to insert a B to make things work. Okay, right. So my path, my gauge fixed path integral will have an extra d theta I need to integrate over. And the d theta will want to have a b to go with it. More precisely, something like an integral of b from 0 to 2 pi or something. Never done it, but I assume it's something like that.
And this is because the space-time is non-trivial?
Yes.
Can I have the same because the gauge group is non-trivial topology?
Yes. If you try to do path integral in instanton sectors, that's another important example. So in an Nobelian gauge theory, let's see. Actually, I'm not sure that's true. Sorry. So. I mean, it depends on the gauge, right? So I don't know. Maybe possible. So I'm not sure that if I mean. So in the Nobelian gauge theory, there is this quantity, the integral of f wedge f on space time, which is some number times an integer. So the path integral of gauge theory has sort of topological sectors above this integer. I could imagine that some gauge fixing would be problematic in instanton sectors, and you might have to allow yourself to integrate over some extra modes. But I don't know for sure.
But that is not similar to what you explained about the complex structure.
Well, the main difference is that it's hard. So here, there was a quantity, which was the integral of A3 from 0 to pi. This quantity is gauge invariant. And so clearly, I cannot gauge fix it away. In the case of complex structure, it's hard to write gauge invariant expressions in the metric which measure the complex structure. Which is not to say that you can't. Let me give you an example. So let's take your surface. Once I have a complex structure, there is a notion of holomorphic function. There is also a notion of holomorphic form. So you can look at something that the form f the z loc, f of z the z locally, or omega, we call it omega, holomorphic form. And you can ask, what's the space of holomorphic form on this Riemann surface? It turns out there is a finite collection of them. Something like G of them. Where G is the genus, the number of handles. Like there's one in the torus, there are going to be two on this surface, and so on. You could ask, how do I know that? Well, it's an anomaly. We'll actually get to do a similar discussion in another session. Now you can also pick paths on your surface. So you can take the integral of your paths of your holomorphic forms. These are going to be some functions, some numbers. Call the periods. And I've only used the complex structure until now. What I've used is complex structure. And of course, I picked some basis for the space of forms and some basis for the space of paths. Can I do a bit better? Well, sometimes the space of paths have an inner product. An intersection product, literally an intersection of the paths. I can find a collection, a maximal collection of paths which have trivial intersection with each other. So I can look at some a I intersect a j equal to 0. And then I can look for dual collection of paths which intersect each a cycle once. I'm going to from memory, okay, so I hope I'm not making a mistake. But now I can say, okay, here I could always multiply the forms by some number, right? So I need to, but I can find the basis such that the integration on the A cycles is delta ij. I'm using the fact that there are actually two G paths on the surface, and I can get G of the A's. Again, non-trivial statements, but two. And then I can look at the integral on the B cycles. I probably also want the BB equals 0. So these are numbers, a collection of complex numbers. They still depend on my choices of A and B cycles. So I might want to change this choice. This choice means that I take this A to a linear combination of A's and B's, and this B to a linear combination of A and B's. It's a big 2G by 2G matrix. It's actually an element of SP 2G valued in integer numbers. If I do such a transformation, my taus will transform in a specific way. I'm not going to describe it to you. It's some fractional linear transformation. And so there is a map from complex structures to tau modulo SP2GZ. Tau is a pretty generic matrix. I mean, One thing you is actually you can show is that the imaginary part of it is positive definite. So you could say this is sort of C to the G squared, sorry, symmetric, so G, G plus 1 over 2 with a condition of this sort. So if you can then build some functions that are invariant under SP, you can actually get finally some coordinates, some actual functions on the complex structures. But it's definitely a complicated procedure. Varies by genus a lot. And also, unfortunately, this map is not one-to-one. So it's one-to-one for the torus, and I think for genus 2-2, maybe 3, I don't remember. But at some point, there are, you know, there are 3G minus 3 dimensional space of complex structure, and this is G square numbers. It's actually a very hard problem to know which collection of numbers can come from a complex structure. And the solution to this problem uses two-dimensional conformal field theory. Okay. I think we can stop here and I can answer questions offline.